Welcome to the Sound of Economics. I am Maria Demertzis, the Deputy Director of Bruegel, the Brussels-based economics think tank. My guest is Martin Sambu. Martin, welcome to Bruegel. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us. And we have asked Martin to help us think a little bit about the future of macro. Martin, about a few months ago, if I am not mistaken, the January of this year, you had written two extensive columns in your free lunch column of the Financial Times, commenting on an attempt that was made by a group of academics, published by Oxford, to discuss the future of macroeconomics, both from a sort of practical point of view, but also from a theoretical point of view, how we teach macroeconomics, what do we want macroeconomics to achieve, and how we design policy based on what we've learned in the past 10 years and beyond that. Could you remind us of the main messages of your two columns back then?
That's right. The two columns addressed a project that was happening at the University of Oxford and that was published in a special issue of the Oxford Review of Economic Policy. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you can include a link on your website for listeners of this podcast. This came out of a multi-year project where several academic economists at Oxford had convened a group of very high-powered, some of the best academic macroeconomists in the world, to think about what, if anything, was wrong with macro and how it needed to be changed if there was anything wrong with it. And this, of course, came out of the crisis and the experience from the crisis, where a lot of people were saying that economics has failed us. Now, you've had economists come with sort of protestations against that, saying, well, you know, there's too much criticism of economics, it wasn't economics' fault, and so on. There's much more to economics than macroeconomics. Macroeconomics gave good advice after the crisis about the need to arrest the downturn and stimulate the economy and so on, the dangers of austerity. Economics got a lot of things right, but it's true that macroeconomics especially got some things wrong. And it's important to realize that most macroeconomists agree with this, and ever since the crisis, they've been scratching their heads and thinking about what did we get wrong and why. And of course, the big thing was not really to see the crisis coming. So there's no doubt that that was a failing, both theoretically and also in terms of the practical role, the public role of macroeconomics as a discipline. Now, macroeconomics came out of the Great Recession, right, in the 30s, as a way to help policymakers manage the economy better so as to make a similar downturn impossible to happen again. To that extent, it succeeded. The Great Recession after 2008 wasn't as bad as the Great Depression in the 1930s. But the crisis came as a surprise, including to macroeconomists who really should have been the best place to know. So there's been a lot of work thinking about why. Some of those reasons are kind of sociological. Academic macroeconomists may follow what happens in finance ministries and treasuries, not so much what happens in financial markets. So they miss some of what happened in the markets. But there was a deeper theoretical problem, I think. In the models, the standard model that is the sort of consensus central standard workhorse of modern macroeconomics, it's called the DSGE model, Dynamic Stochastic General Equilibrium. This sort of thing wasn't really supposed to happen, right? It's a sort of well-behaved model where you have small deviations and things go back to normal eventually by themselves. So part of the project at Oxford that was reported in this special issue of Oxrep and that I wrote about was these economists thinking hard about what was wrong with the model, how could it be improved, and I think it wasn't the only effort of that kind, but I think maybe the best and most comprehensive to date, where they came together to see, okay, let's talk about this, let's admit the problems, and let's try to fix it. So that was the background. Now, whenever you get a group of, let's say 10 economists together, you get at least 10, if not more, opinions out of it. And this was no different. But still, there was, I think, a surprising degree of agreement that there were some central problems that pretty much everyone agreed more or less needed to be done something about. And then people were very varied a lot in the details. But I think one thing that came out of this was the difficulty of a model that's designed to have one equilibrium, one central outcome that things come back to after small fluctuations, as the self-stabilizing property of the model. That is a problem in a world of financial markets where it seems that things can flip and make large movements from one place to another, unpredictably and violently, and not return to where it was before. So that's kind of the core finding of something that didn't really work in the model.
Yeah, but if I may go back, go back a step in this conversation, as if one of the things that always strike me in this in the way that we talk about the future of economics is not that there is models that are wrong. I mean, model is a theoretical exercise whereby you start with some inputs and you get into the outputs, and of course the outputs are directly linked to the inputs. What you put in the model is what the model will tell you will happen. But I think that more of the, if you like, what you called the mistakes prior to the crisis, were not so much about the choice of the models, but how we chose to trust certain models and therefore believe that they correspond to a certain truth in the way that we see them. When actually models are by design limited, and therefore they're only there to ask very simple questions, when actually reality and the policy that follows reality are a lot more complicated. So rather than the models themselves, I think the way that we chose as macroeconomists to trust the models is very much, in my view, more in the direction of the mistake that we made. This is why you see that policymakers, particularly central banks, who are very big on modeling, they don't rely on just the one model. And this is where I think the future of macro needs to be. Not that the models are wrong. Models may be less or more suited depending on the problem you're wishing to address. But relying on the just model to get a global view of any policy question that you're trying to answer is, in my view, where I think the problem was. So it's not that we need to find new models. There are models out there. It's just that we need to understand that certainly in a discipline which isn't a pure science, it's a discipline that relies on a lot of other sociology, psychology, things that are not so easy to model. So if that is true, then where does this concept of, you know, what you said, the one equilibrium, how do we inform ourselves about multiple equilibriums, a variety of different positions that we can end up with, and how do we use that in actual policymaking?
Let me respond broadly first to what you've said. You're right, of course. Doing economics properly, especially in order to inform policy decisions, is an exercise in part of modeling, but in large part of choosing the right models, choosing the appropriate models to the situation at hand. And nobody's explained this and emphasized this better than Danny Roderick, who everyone should read on this topic. A lot of good economics is about knowing, and it's a sort of wisdom rather than technical knowledge to judge which model is appropriate. So, for example, among the variants of DSGE models, you could have some that include or don't include household debt as an important factor, for example. Right? Now, we know that you wouldn't get a good view of what was happening in the economy in 2008 if you had a model that didn't have household debt or indeed the banking system as an important component. Those were kind of key channels by which both the build-up, the instability, and the crisis manifested itself and the consequences came out. So you would have needed to choose the right model. So there's a question then to be asked about what happened, what went wrong in terms of the choice of modeling. So maybe there were central banks who used these sorts of models, but clearly those were not the models that ultimately guided the main policymakers, because otherwise they would have taken different decisions to forestall or reduce the dangers of a crisis. Yeah. And we know that they didn't expect a crisis at the time, pretty much every central banker. So that's one problem. And that's maybe something that technical economics can't answer. It's something about how the profession carries out the work. Something about having less groupthink, being more open to other alternative viewpoints and so on. But that's one thing. But even in the model, so I would push back, I think, a little bit at what I think you're saying. I think there's something in the structure of the whole family of models, the DSGE models, and also non-DSGE models, that make it very hard to accept this multiple equilibrium story. And so if almost the whole family, the whole range of models that are intellectually accepted in the field make it very hard to formulate something that is actually the truth of the matter in terms of how the economy works, then clearly we have a problem. I think the reason why we've struggled as economists with the notion of multiple equilibria is twofold. One is that it can be messy in terms of technical work. It's mathematically harder. You know, game theory knows how to deal with this, but it's kind of harder to have the neat final results and the predictions that the single equilibrium models can give you. And that links up to another fact, which is that there's a demand on economists for producing predictions. And, you know, reasonably so, right? What is an economist for if they can't help you find, you know, think about what will happen 1 or 2 or 3 years down the line if you choose one policy over another? That's kind of the point. But I don't think there's a very good reason why multiple equilibria were not taken all that seriously in a lot of modeling, other than, you know, partly a sort of professional embarrassment. I mean, remember the old joke about whichever US president was it Truman, who said, give me a one-handed economist, because every economist would say on the one hand, on the other hand. So it's clearly, you know, it doesn't make you look quite as convincing if you say, well, actually, two things can happen if you do this. One is if everyone is optimistic, you'll have a good outcome. And if everyone is pessimistic, you'll have a bad outcome. And the policymaker will say, well, thanks, but how does that help me make a decision? And the honest answer is, well, it might not help you as much as you'd like. But I think that's something we need to be a bit more comfortable with, to say, well, look, these are possible outcomes of the policy. And it's more likely that you get one of these two extremes than that you get something in the middle. So if you think about how a lot of central banks work, they give these central projections. They'll give, the Bank of England will give a fan chart that has a probability distribution around a single outcome, a single prediction. The Fed will have the dot plot, which is, you know, has a similar function. But I don't know of anyone who says, well, actually, depending on, to use an old Keynesian word, animal spirits in the financial markets or among entrepreneurs, we think that it's likely that we have a sort of bimodal future. We might end up here with pretty strong growth or here with pretty weak growth. And, you know, which one happens depends a little bit on what expectations agents in the economy coordinate on. That's a complicated message to formulate, to defend to policymakers, and to communicate to the public. All of those are difficult, but I think that's something we have to learn to do better.
So that's exactly where then we need to start the conversation. Okay, what should the future macro look like? So if I understand you correctly then, so you want to push back from the emphasis that we give on predictions and the probabilities that we attach across predictions. And so there, do you see a role for economists actually informing the public that actually these predictions aren't as strong as numbers, as probabilities actually imply? And it's important that we try and understand that there is an uncertainty out there. There is a lack of knowledge out there. And we cannot always put a number to what happened to the future because the probabilities refer to past events. So this is something I think that we need to think about as we move forward, and your views here will be quite interesting. How should we design macro to simply account for this problem, to say that, you know, there's, you know, move away the emphasis from probabilities, design methods, don't necessarily models, but methods that you can approach systematically a particular issue, but don't fall yourself into the false certainty of what prediction accounts give us, because they may go very wrong, and occasionally they do. But how do you go about constructing a discipline, macroeconomics, and educating and from the students of macroeconomics all the way to the consumers of macroeconomics, which is basically everyone, and inform them about the pitfalls of numbers and the false security that they represent?
There's one criticism you hear from outside of economics, or at least outside of mainstream academic economics, which is radical and says the whole framework needs to be ditched. DSGE models have to go out the window and so on. So I don't agree with that. And I think that to get back to this Oxford project, I think what was very valuable there was a good effort at showing that actually you can salvage some of the standard way of doing macroeconomics, but incorporate the insights we've just talked about, these more realistic admissions of how the economy works, that there are these unpredictabilities. There's a value in having a kind of baseline central consensus model. And for better or worse, DSG is sort of that. And the value is that a lot of different economists have a language to talk to each other. The technical bits of policymaking have a language to talk to each other. The problem isn't so much that there was that one model, but that the technical language it provided, the lingua franca of mainstream macroeconomics, made it very hard to talk about certain phenomena that, of course, are important in the economy, multiple equilibria and financial markets being the most important, but more generally the role of debt, accumulated debt balances. The other thing that the project did very well, I think, which is why I wrote about it, is that there were a number of examples in it where scholars did the work to show, look, this is how you could redesign a DSG model, staying within the overall technical way of doing macro, but incorporating enough factors that it's still tractable, but you can actually model a situation where different outcomes are possible, different multiple equilibria are possible, so that you can have a DSG model that describes a world where in one state of the world, things are fine, you have regular growth, you have this sort of great moderation, things are nice development, but with the right kind of external disruption, a shock, you can get into a downturn that you may or may not recover fully from, depending on various factors. So you start to be able to use the same framework, but to describe a richer world. And you're right, the outcome of that is that you may be able to have a less firm prediction. You might say that this could happen or that could happen, and we can't give you a probability of each. But there's still a lot that you can say. You can say it depends on these things. And importantly, it can help you identify policies that will help to either keep you in the good equilibrium or think about how to bounce back to the good equilibrium if you are in the bad equilibrium, if you don't even admit the difference. And I fear this is what has happened in macroeconomic policy making in the last 7, 8, 9, 10 years, especially in Europe maybe, is a sort of fatalism, right? If your intellectual framework says after a while you come back to the best place you can be, then you'll resign yourself to saying, well, this is the best we can do. And you kind of rule out of bounds the possibility that actually we could be doing a lot better.
We're slowly coming to an end, but before we finish, I would like you to sort of look into your crystal ball and try and predict the types of problems that we are going to try and not predict, but perhaps think of the types of problems that we are going to face, let's say in the next 10 to 20 years on the macro side. And now I'll give you carte blanche to design a new curriculum for macroeconomics. If you could give me just one thing that you would do differently from the way you did macro or from the perhaps the way you were taught macro.
Well, I think there are two levels of teaching. There's the undergraduate level and the graduate level. The graduate level is for the technical people who will try and do this. And here I'm pretty optimistic because if this sort of work on adapting the workhorse model continues, we're going to be in good shape. At the undergraduate level, that's where you educate, you know, in part the future policymakers, people who won't be professional economists but will have to deal with economics. And the ideas you give them are important. Because either they can't make sense of the world or they will reject economics because it didn't give them the right tools. So I think the bigger challenge is actually at the undergraduate level, the sort of introductory economics. So let me mention a couple of points off the top of my head. First, you have to be able to talk about crises. We've all lived through a big financial crisis, and we know that these are recurrent phenomena. We need to equip every undergraduate economics student with a way to think about this. And we can do this, right? You can use basic game theory, which everyone is taught at the undergraduate level, to also think about the macroeconomy. And you can teach intuitions and simple theories about multiple equilibria in a financial context and in a macroeconomic context. And in a sense, that would actually be true to teaching Keynes, if you like, which you also should do in an undergraduate course. So that's one thing. It's kind of straightforward to explain. It's harder to do, but I think there's a realization that we have to do that. Beyond that, in terms of macro, I think it's quite important to be a bit better at bringing together macro and micro, because some of the big challenges in macroeconomic policy have micro roots. So I think one thing that's very interesting at the moment is something that economists were late to but are now doing is to think about, for example, the role of inequality or the structure of the distribution of household incomes or the structure of household debts and the effect of that on macroeconomic policy. So if you think about how the distribution of debt overhangs among households will matter for how effective low interest rates are for stimulating the economy. And similarly, the build-up, the distribution of the build-up of debt will affect regionally how a financial crisis happens. Where are the housing markets crashing and where are they not? And that in turn will have macroeconomic consequences. So I think there's something to do on marrying micro and macro a little bit better than we normally do, certainly in teaching, but even in the practice of both theoretical economics or research economics and economic policy. But I think these are some examples of how you can make economics look more real, be more real, but also look more real to the student in the classroom. And that can only be a good thing.
That's great, Martin. So two things we've learned then today. Talk about crisis. We need to learn to talk about crisis because we will see them over and over again. And then marry micro and macro better so that the storytelling that comes with that, with our policy decision, is more persuasive and more rich. Martin, that's wonderful. Thank you very much for joining us. That will be all for The Sound of Economics in this episode. Join us again for the next episode of Sound Economics. Thank you very much.